If you lead with passion rather than profit, you can actually see a change in children eating better.
And I mean, what are the ways that you think you'll adjust to this new guidance? Do you think it's going to be costly to do? Are you looking forward to changing the menus?
I feel like we're already at the stage. I think when I go through the changes, I don't know if there's much we actually need to change at the moment. We don't really fry here. You know, we reduced our puddings to twice a week. All the other days it's fruit and yogurt. Some days it's just fruit. So with the changes coming in, I would say that we're already starting to implement those changes. So it won't be very different.
Okay, it's fascinating. Well, thank you so much, Nathan Scarlett, chef at Henry Cavendish Primary School, and Anna Taylor, executive director at the Food Foundation. That's it from me today. Trevor Phillips is back in tomorrow, and next on Times Radio, it's Jane and Fee.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Very good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
And on the programme today, the Southport attacks were not a bolt from the blue and could have been prevented if warnings had been heeded. We'll hear more about that judgment from an inquiry with the Times' chief political commentator, Patrick Maguire, who grew up in Southport. Donald Trump's blockade of the already shut Strait of Hormuz begins in an hour's time after talks with Iran failed over the weekend. We'll talk to the ex-US negotiator Alan Eyre about how he managed to reach an agreement with the Iranians and what might happen next this time round. We'll chat books with the Times literary team and new employment rights with our money man Adam Shaw. Plus, the rapper Big Nasty wants people to ask for his brand of super strength medicinal cannabis. Should celebrities be allowed to endorse medical products?
All of that happens after the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. A public inquiry found the Southport murders could and should have been prevented by the authorities and the killer's parents. Its chair says Axel Rudakabana had clearly revealed he was in extreme danger long before his knife attack that killed three schoolgirls at a Taylor Swift dance class in July 2024.
He was not suffering from any kind of mental illness. He fueled his perversely violent fixation by viewing a wide range of deeply inappropriate and disturbing subjects.
Sir Adrian Fulford's made 67 recommendations, including limiting internet access for dangerous young people. The US military has issued a capture warning to vessels attempting to break its blockade of maritime traffic using Iranian ports. Tehran says no ports in the Middle East will be safe if the action goes ahead in the next hour, as oil prices jump above $100 a barrel. Meanwhile, Sir Keir Starmer's insisted Britain would not get dragged into the war, adding his priority remains the reopening of the Hormuz Strait. Yazid Sayer from the Malcolm H. Kerr Carnegie Middle East Centre told Times Radio Tehran holds the upper hand.
They can inflict disproportionate pain on the rest of the world and on the Arab Gulf states that rely on shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. And it's bad enough for international shipping to have to come to paying Iran a fee for transit, but at least that way the shipping can actually move, versus a situation where the Iranians say, OK, if you're going to blockade our ports, then no one else is going to be able to move their ships through the strait either.
Donald Trump's accused the Pope of being weak on crime and terrible for foreign policy. Leo XIV has called on both Tehran and Washington to seek peace during his Easter sermons. He's previously criticised the White House's approach to immigration. On his way to Algeria, the American pontiff said he had no fear of the Trump administration.
I do not look at my role as being political or politician. I don't want to get into a debate with him. I don't think that the message of the gospel is meant to be abused in the way that some people are doing.
Hungary's new prime minister insists his government will do everything to start a new era. Peter Meyer says he'll work every day and every hour of the day to improve the country's security and development. Gregory Roos is director of the Europe and Russia and Eurasia programs at Chatham House.
What has really made him stand out is absolute rejection of corruption and also the criticism of the tightened grip of the government on the media and the judiciary, which had become too obvious to many voters at a time when inflation was on the rise, where commodity prices were on the rise, where energy prices were on the rise.
A new report warns NHS patients face some of the worst survival rates in the developed world, despite record funding for the health service. The IPPR says an analysis of 22 countries found the NHS is the second worst performer, ahead only of the United States on preventable deaths. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon. We are back. We very much hope you enjoyed your week in the company of Asma Mir last week, but I'm afraid there's no escape. We are obliged to be with you, and you'll have to put up with it. We're here until 4 o'clock. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. Looking forward to your company this afternoon. And please do make contact on the WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. So the US blockade of the Strait of Hormuz starts in about an hour's time. We will talk later in the programme, in fact, just after the news at three, to a man who has successfully negotiated with the Iranians in the past. We'll discuss the Hillsborough Law. It's designed to stop cover-ups. So will spies really give evidence to public inquiries in the future? Big Nasty's medicinal cannabis company, more on that a little bit later. And let's be honest, not everybody suits green, but thank goodness Rory McIlroy wears it so well. He's only gone and won another Masters, and that means, Fee, he gets to wear...
the green jacket.
The green jacket. More with Vassos when we talk sport. I think it's the... and people can correct me on this. I think it is the only sporting event which gives a jacket.
Oh, I'm not sure about that.
Oh. Well, what other sport gives a jacket?
Well, we know that there are yellow jerseys available... but I've got a feeling that there might be other jackets involved. I'm going to do a little bit of private time research on that during the next item.
All right, thank you. More jacket news coming your way. Susie Goldsborough from the Times Books team will discuss the story that is creating quite the buzz in literary circles. Is the Booker Prize winner Flesh just too close to William Makepeace Thackeray's Barry Lyndon?
What would your answer be to that?
I'm afraid I'm not in a position to comment, but I imagine most of our listeners will have a view, and you can certainly let us know. And workers' rights is the subject for personal finance guru Adam Shaw with us at around about 10 to 4 this afternoon. So what are the most read stories on the Times website?
Well, in at number 3, it is the Hungary election celebration of democracy as Viktor Orban ousted. Peter Mudger said on Sunday night that his election rival had called to congratulate him on victory after a record turnout at the polls. The second most read story so far today, Iran war latest, that is our live page, UK not joining US blockade of Strait of Hormuz. Sir Keir Starmer insisted Britain wasn't getting dragged into the war and his priority was the reopening of the shipping lane. And the most read piece on the Times website, Trump posts image of himself as Jesus after attacking Pope Leo. The pontiff has spoken out after the US president shared the AI-generated image of himself on Truth Social and criticised Leo as being weak on crime. On a flight to Algiers, the Pope said the message of the gospel was being abused.
I do not look at my role as being political or politician. I don't want to get into a debate with him. I don't think that the message of the gospel is meant to be abused in the way that some people are doing. And I will continue to speak out loudly against war, looking to promote peace, promoting dialogue and multilateral relationships among the states to look for just solutions to problems. Too many people are suffering in the world today. Too many innocent people are being killed. And I think someone has to stand up and say there's a better way to do this.
I tell you what, everything these days happens on a plane, doesn't it? If you haven't seen the image that Trump has posted of himself as Jesus, it really is worth a look, as is Gavin Newsom's image of Trump.
He's done
one too, where Trump is very much the Grim Reaper in exactly the same pose. And it's become the kind of... it's like a Russian doll of idolatry going on there. How many people can generate an image that is in some way going to definitely offend somebody? You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com to subscribe. If you are a digital subscriber, it's not just today's articles you can read. You get access to the full archive online. Over the last couple of days, for instance, we have had revealing interviews with Grayson Perry and Noah Wyle. So if you want to read those plus all of the features, you just head to our website or app and check them out.
Quite a lot of jacket news, as it turns out. Helen says Roger Federer gave himself that monogram jacket when he won Wimbledon. Yes, I remember that. I'm afraid I lost a bit of respect for him there. It was a bit silly. What's this from Becky? In women's tennis, Billie Jean King Cup hands out a blue jacket to the winners. It's Billie Blue, which is the colour of Billie Jean King's trainers when she won the Battle of the Sexes match.
Well, there you go. And darts awards jackets as well. And Rob Malarkey has sent us some very, very fine photographic evidence of the Austrian Darts Open presenting a green jacket.
Yeah, I think too.
That's jacket's
that,
a go-go.
Is that Luke Littler sporting that Austrian jacket?
It is, yeah.
It is. Who knew there were so many jackets in sport?
I tell you what, they should have turned the sleeves up for him. They look very, very long, don't they?
Yes, that's it's not actually a great fit, that jacket, if I was going to be, I agree with you.
Well, it would interfere with your flight, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, it would. Any more thoughts on sartorial gifts handed out to winners of sporting events? 0333 003 2353. Now, the Southport attack. It wasn't a bolt from the blue and it could have been stopped. That is according to an inquiry. The chair, Sir Adrian Fulford, described the litany of failures by public bodies that led to the attack by Axel Rudakabana.
One of the most striking conclusions from this inquiry's extensive investigation is the sheer number of the missed opportunities over many years to intervene meaningfully, which directly contributed to the failure to avert this disaster. Numerous systems that should have provided oversight, assessment and protection were ineffective or inadequately used. Some failed outright. The consequences, as it does not need for me to say, were catastrophic.
Sir Adrian Fulford, he also went on to criticise the parents of Rudakabana, saying that they obstructed attempts to intervene before the attack. Now, we know that the lives of three very young girls were taken in this incident and so many more lives utterly blighted. Let's talk to The Times chief political commentator, Patrick Maguire. I know, Patrick, you are from Southport. This has touched you personally. And it's just worth saying that Southport is a proud and rather stately seaside resort. But now, whenever anybody thinks of it, they think of this.
Oh, absolutely, Jane. And that, as a sandgrounder, to use the preferred demonym of people from Southport, it's been a surreal experience, having spent a lifetime, not for people like yourself who are from Merseyside, but most people confused it with Stockport. You'd have to explain exactly where it was. But in an instant, that's a change in the most depraved and sickening way possible. And for the name Southport to become a sort of English version of Dunblane, always associated in the minds of the nation with one tragedy that we're still talking about, you know, nearly 2 years since that very fateful day in July 2024 is, you know, almost indescribable for people in a town like Southport, a town that is associated for people in the area with a place that, you know, this sort of place where nothing bad could ever happen to your children. Indeed, that's why so many people move there and make homes there.
So tell us about the findings of this inquiry, because it actually is of no comfort whatsoever to discover that there were so many missed opportunities to stop this dreadful event.
Yeah, indeed. Look, it's a catalogue of state failure at every conceivable level, and a failure actually of personal responsibility, as Sir Adrian Fulford said. You know, first of all, the failure of Axel Rudakabana's parents to take responsibility and intervene and ensure their son was being held accountable for behaviour. The finding too that he wasn't suffering from mental illness or any condition that would have made him behave in this way beyond his pretty well documented fixation with extreme violence. The failure of agencies to talk to each other or take responsibility for his behaviour, and just a sort of the patchwork of dysfunction across local government boundaries, police negligence, all of this adding up to, as the chair of the inquiry said there, the most incalculable human cost that is possible. You know, that, as you say, there's no solace for the family because it is just a long list of people who ought to have stopped this long before he'd gone that taxi to Hart Street.
The parents have been criticised, I think notably the father. Isn't it, though, true that they had attempted to get help for their son?
Yes, it is. And, you know, repeatedly you see that pattern play out, trying to find the right person to intervene, the conversations happening between state agencies, law enforcement and their son. And so, yes, the parents are criticised, but it's, you know, not entirely true, as you say, that they did nothing. But, you know, as is understandable, it's the focus on those last few weeks, what was withheld from the police, law enforcement, the sort of people that would have been able to take him into care or custody for fear of him getting in trouble, despite his having been in trouble several times before. You know, and it is notable that no one person is blamed, because I think the blame apportioned here is necessarily broad, as you say. You know, yes, the parents didn't do everything right, but nor did a whole range of people with infinitely more power than them.
Possibly because some of the individuals in those bodies and all these institutions and organisations are made up of individuals. They can't think the unthinkable because, mercifully, so very few human beings would carry out acts as hideous as those carried out by Rudha Kabana on that day.
And look, the other thing we've got to take into account here, you know, there was loads of discussion, obviously, almost immediately after the attack. Was this a terrorist attack? Was he ideologically motivated? Obviously, there was the Al-Qaeda manual on his computer. There was the ricin he was attempting to manufacture in his family home. But it's that phrase I used before, his fixation with extreme violence. This is basically, and several experts have since pointed this out, this is a new kind of offending, you know, sort of, and it's really hard to compute in its depravity because it's almost without precedent. You know, it's just this extreme nihilistic violence for its own sake, not necessarily in service of any ideology or political aim, just wanting to inflict pain and being obsessed with violence and hurting people. And you know, several experts point out this sort of nihilistic violence perpetrated by often very young men and adolescents like Rudha Kabana is increasingly a fixture of the risks people face. And, you know, but, you know, if you are a social worker in provincial England, how much of this are you familiar with or have you encountered before? And as you say, nobody ever wants to imagine the worst. So, you know, state failure, as you've said, Jane, is, you know, often born of several, you know, layers of individuals making decisions that turn out to be really, really misguided.
It's not a coincidence, is it, that he targeted young girls at a dance class with a Taylor Swift theme? There is a misogyny at the heart of this, isn't there? Perhaps we've perhaps ignored that up to a point. I mean, this is a young man who targeted very young girls quite deliberately.
Yeah, indeed. And look, clearly he wanted to kill as easily as he could. You know, there's the video now, the infamous video of his father dragging him out of a taxi that was destined for his former school, you know, the school he had been expelled from and turned up with weapons in the past. And we can only surmise that the reason he chose the event that he did was because he would encounter a room where the only adults were women and all of the potential victims were girls who could not defend themselves, even against a slight 17-year-old boy. And that is ultimately, almost certainly, what happened here. And it's you can't ignore that fact.
What about the long-lasting impact on Southport? Is there anything positive that's come out of this. And we should say, of course, that the many people were injured on that day. They will never recover. They'll never lose those memories. The whole thing is truly dire. But has something, some kind of cohesion, some community spirit come out of all this?
Oh, definitely, because, you know, just if the killings were traumatic and they were the most traumatic event in the town's history, compounding that grief and compounding that shock were the scenes the following night when people marched on the town's mosque and chucked bricks and, you know, behaved like thugs and lunatics. And that, you know, there was a narrative put about afterwards that that was, you know, solely out of town. As no doubt people did travel for trouble, but the uncomfortable fact was lots of those people were local, but they were vastly outnumbered by the number of people who came out the following day to repair buildings and gave their own money to help rebuild the town. I think it has, you know, it has brought the town closer together in really difficult circumstances. You know, all three of the parents involved have set up charity in the girls' memories and are, you know, mainstays of charity fundraising in the town and will have the town support to count on forever. But, you know, that is obviously no solace to them, and it's no solace to the town. But, you know, we saw, I think, in that week and since, the best and worst of a community that is unaccustomed to the spotlight, indeed, you know, deliberately shuns it, but I think he's trying to make the best of what it can.
Thank you very much, Patrick. That's Patrick Maguire, who is The Times' chief political commentator.
Anything that we're talking about this afternoon, we'd love to hear your thoughts about. We're 0333 003 2353. A change of direction in a couple of moments' time. Should celebrities be allowed to endorse medical products? It's 20 minutes past two.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio. Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation, telling the stories that matter, alongside a world-class lineup of guests, experts and contributors. There's a merry band of erudite intellectuals who join us every evening. Michael Binion.
We had a very interesting meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
Zoe Strimple.
There is real unease.
And Peter Hitchens, to name a few.
This is war, for goodness sake. Nobody tells the truth about what's going on.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Smelling like cocoa, but I'm in Versace blue jeans. Ben Sherman top with blue jeans. Going in.
Well, it's one of Jane Garvey's favourite tunes there. London-born grime artist Big Nasty. Now, this is a very serious topic, actually.
Yes, it is.
He's launched a medical cannabis company. Now, the company's website advises customers on how to qualify for medical cannabis treatment. Here he is.
Well, one peeps, it's your boy Big Nasty. If you've got long-term pain, anxiety, PTSD, insomnia or any other conditions what regular medicine hasn't fixed, this video could change everything for you. I'm in one of the leading medical cannabis facilities, home of the B&M. This is where medicine starts. Everything here is grown under strict medical standards, tested then shipped to the UK for patients who qualify. By the end of this video, you'll know how to become a medical cannabis patient, what to prepare and how to get your prescription as quickly as possible.
Well, until Friday, Big Nasty's company stated it was in a partnership with Integro Clinics, a specialist cannabis clinic led by a senior NHS consultant. But that claim was removed after contact by The Times. Andrew Elson is the consumer affairs correspondent at The Times, and he's in the studio with us now. Andrew, I think an awful lot of people might need us to go back to basics with this one and start with what medical cannabis is and who can be buying it at the moment before we even get to Big Nasty.
Well, medical cannabis was legalised in 2018, so more than 7 years ago now. And people might be quite surprised, but nearly two-thirds of all medical cannabis that is now prescribed is just the flower of the plant that you might recognise from a street dealer. However, it's grown under professional conditions, so they know exactly what the strength is, they know exactly what the strains are, and the key is the sort of relative amount of THC to CBD and other cannabinoids. So it's there are also oils and drops and some other ways to consume it, but most people who take it or buy these prescriptions, because they're all done privately because you can't really get it on the NHS, they get the flower, the plant.
So who is usually applying for a prescription for medical cannabis?
Well, this is the interesting thing. The law was changed, and I was actually at the forefront of the campaign to change the law, because there was some epileptic children who had intractable epilepsy, serious and dangerous fits that could cost them their life. And it turned out that cannabis really, really helped them. Now, fast forward 8 years, those kids are not the majority of people getting these drugs. We think it's hard to say because there's not much transparency in the industry, but from reports that we've seen, about 60% of all people who are getting medical cannabis are doing it for mental health conditions such as depression and anxiety. And I think that's where people are particularly concerned, because medical cannabis undoubtedly can help a lot of people. It can be good for chronic pain. It can help people with cancer. It can help them get their appetite back. It can relieve the pain. It's proven for epilepsy in young children. There's lots of conditions that we know it really helps, but the Royal College of Psychiatrists says there's insufficient evidence to say it helps mental health conditions. That's not to say it doesn't help some people.
But it's also very bad for some people.
Indeed. They also say it can make matters worse. And very recently we had the really tragic case of Oliver Robinson, who was 34, and he had depression and psychosis and addictive tendencies, and he was prescribed by the Curaleaf Clinic high-strength medical cannabis. He very sadly ended up taking his own life. It turned out at the inquest that they hadn't even been in contact with his NHS psychiatrist or the Priory Clinic, where he was also at. And the woman who saw him was actually a child psychiatrist and had no history of dealing with adults with mental health problems. And so something seems to be going wrong when that can happen.
Where does the Integro Clinic lie in this story that you've pursued for The Times?
Very, very difficult to say exactly, because when I first started looking at Big Nasty, Integro Clinic's name was sort of plastered all over the website. But when I contacted Integro Clinics, they denied that they had any kind of financial relationship or had never paid him any money, although they did admit that they are prescribing his medical cannabis drugs, which are high-strength drugs, typically twice the strength of skunk you might get on the streets. These are not necessarily drugs you should take lightly. And so it was surprising what was happening. He then took down the references to Integro Clinic, and so on the face of what we know, it seems that the only kickback he's been getting from referring patients to Integro Clinics is that they prescribe some of his medicine. Now, what's particularly interesting around this market is it's the Human Medicines Regulation 2012 actually say it's illegal to promote a prescription medicine. You're simply not allowed to do it. And that involves advertising, that involves social media influencers. It covers the whole lot. So it's very surprising when you see, well, you see clinics like Curaleaf now advertising on the TV, but you also see Big Nasty all over Instagram promoting this. Now, they argue that they can do this because they're not actually promoting the medicine itself, they're promoting the services of the clinic, which seems a slightly questionable grey area. It's regulated by the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, who take a slightly laissez-faire approach, and they don't look into this at all unless they receive a complaint. Right.
Now, Andrew, there's a king-size Rizzler between those things, isn't there? and that's the problem, isn't it? That actually, for particularly a young person who goes online in search of a place to buy cannabis, a well-known celebrity with a huge fan base saying, this is great, this is cool, this is available.
And legal.
And legal. I mean, those are all the red flags, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I think the principal concern that people have is that so many young people... Well, I think there's two things happening. I think there's what you might call a pseudo-recreational market where people are feigning having one of these mental health conditions as the easiest and quickest way to get hold of these drugs legally. And if the police then stop them, then they just show their prescription and they're okay. But I think the other half of it is that people who are perhaps have these mental health conditions that should be getting different types of treatment, counselling or anything, are potentially taking a drug from a private clinic who's making a lot of money to keep them rotating on these monthly prescriptions for something that could actually make them worse. And I think the Oliver Robinson's brother, Alexander Robinson, has now started this campaign, and it's called Oliver's Law, and he would like to see all these private medical clinics making it mandatory for them to speak to, if someone comes in claiming mental health problems, to speak to their NHS or other medical person who's been dealing with that before they do a prescription, and also greater transparency to say they can't do it on over Zoom, because most of these prescriptions are short consultations over Zoom, make them come in, make them see someone, so they can get a proper idea what they are, and also transparency on the amount that's being prescribed, because some of these clinics are, a previous article I did a couple of weeks ago, are prescribing huge amounts of these drugs, which raises the question, are they really giving their patients the oversight that they need?
Is Big Nasty doing something that he could be legally pursued over?
No, I don't necessarily think so. He could potentially get in trouble with the MHPRA, so a bit of a mouthful, because they regulate the advertising of drugs. And one professor said to me, you don't see people advertising opioid clinics or steroid clinics or penicillin clinics. And it seems to be a bit of a scam that they're getting away with this advertising. So I don't think he's not doing anything illegal. However, there are questions. I would say it's a grey area over his approach and whether it meets those regulations. And I think a lot of people would say, particularly given the number of young people on TikTok and Instagram, the two channels where he's very big, you could say it's irresponsible what he's doing. Mm.
Thank you very much. That is really informative stuff. Andrew Elson, you can read all about it if you've got your Times digital subscription. It's up there now.
Next on Times Radio, could a government U-turn see spies forced to give evidence to public inquiries? It is just after 2:30, but only just, unusually for us. Here are the headlines with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. A public inquiry has found the Southport murders could have been prevented if the killer's parents and authorities had acted in the years leading up to the crime. Axel Rudikabana's attack, which killed three young girls and wounded several others, follow what the report calls systematic failures. It also says his actions were repeatedly excused. Sir Keir Starmer says British warships won't be involved in an American blockade on Iranian ports, which is due to start in the next half hour. Donald Trump's ordered the US Navy to stop vessels using them from entering or leaving the Strait of Hormuz after peace talks with Iran broke down. Tehran's called the move ridiculous and laughable. EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen says it'll hit European pockets too.
They feel the impact at the gas station, they feel the impact in the supermarket, on the household bills. So what we are seeing in the Middle East is not some distant crisis, but in a world in which everything is connected, the effects are direct and they are immediate.
Meanwhile, Pope Leo says he'll continue to speak out against war despite Donald Trump's scathing attack overnight. The US president accused the pontiff of being weak on crime and terrible for foreign policy. Hungary's new prime minister says there's no time to lose, declaring he wants it to be a European country again. Peter Maggiar has defeated the far-right leader Viktor Orban after 16 years in power. Ministers hope proposed changes to school lunches in England will tackle obesity and tooth decay. Sausage rolls and pizzas could be replaced by whole grain breads and pasta. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
You've saved carefully for your future, your plans, your peace of mind. Now there's good news. FSCS protection for your savings and current accounts has risen to £120,000 per eligible person at UK authorised banks, building societies and credit unions. From the very first pound right up to £120,000, it's all protected. So you can focus on what matters with confidence. See what it means for you at fscs.org.uk. Your savings, FSCS protected.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, Sue asks if we're going to invite Big Nasty onto our programme to explain himself. And we're very happy to put out a request. It'd be very interesting to talk to him about his promotion of his medical cannabis. It's probably not where John Pienaar's going to start his show today, though. Hello, John.
Hi there. It'd be a shame. I think Big Nasty's a good interviewee. I've seen him, you know, he's a very colourful character, has a very substantial presence in every conceivable way.
Well, we'll send out our invitation, hope he accepts.
But he's not called Big Nasty for nothing, is he?
He's not. But he's not as nasty as his name implies.
Is he as
well,
big
not when
as...
Not when he's giving interviews, anyway.
Is he big?
He's very big.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he's really surrounded by other very big people.
Right.
Well, he can come and meet two very small women. We'll see how it goes.
All right, so on the show, so what is it? It's now 2:34. So the blockade has been in effect, apparently, for 34 minutes, our time. Well, 34 minutes in anyone's time. And we don't know how it's working, if it's working, or to what extent, if any. But I'll be trying to find out on the programme, because we can see the movements of shipping on the Strait of Hormuz. Now we've got the American blockade on top of the effective block from Iran. Why is it happening? Why is it happening like this? It's not at all clear. And is it clear to the president? So I'm going to be talking to a former American ambassador to Lebanon about that. I'm going to be hearing, of course, from Catherine Philp, our World Affairs editor. And meanwhile, we've got the Hungary story, which is a really substantial one. And so I'm talking to Kira Rudik, the Ukrainian MP and leader of an opposition party, about what looks like very good news for Ukraine. Now that this man, Orban, is out of the way of EU efforts to help Ukraine. So what's it going to mean in that country and for the war? And what might it mean for the American response? Because Orban was, of course, Donald Trump's pick.
Thank you very much. John takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon, and we're going to talk about the Strait of Hormuz after 3 o'clock on this programme too.
We are, and we're grateful to Tracy, who's just contacted us via WhatsApp, just to really sing the praises of Budapest. She says what a beautiful city it is. And I think it's fair to say that it's at their parliament building that we've been seeing quite a lot of the last couple of days because of the election coverage. Absolutely magnificent. I'm going to say it for you, I think it's better and what we've got here.
Oh, blimey, love. I know. It's only Monday.
I haven't been to Budapest, but I really must make an effort. Look out, Hungary. You lucky devils. Right, it's 24 minutes to 3 o'clock. Now, the heads of MI5 and MI6 will no longer be given the power to stop individual spies from giving evidence to public inquiries. This is according to The Times. Protections for the security services in the new Hillsborough law are expected to be watered down after a backlash from some MPs and from bereaved families. The law is meant to stop official cover-ups by introducing a so-called duty of candour, forcing public authorities to tell the truth in any inquiry. Let's talk to Duncan Gardam, who's a journalist who focuses on security issues. Potentially, this U-turn is very significant, Duncan. Are you pleased about it?
Well, I'm not sure it's a matter for me, to be honest. I think the issue really is for families who are going through these inquiries, and they're sort of confronted by public bodies, often with ranks of lawyers, who are using all that legal power to decide what to disclose to the inquiry and what not to disclose. And the concern really is among the families, and it originally came out of Hillsborough, but it's been reflected at the Manchester Arena inquiry and others, is that the public bodies don't have this duty to disclose everything and to be honest and helpful to the inquiry. And that's quite often what ends up happening, is that the public bodies end up in a kind of oppositional sense. Instead of trying to help the inquiry, they end up trying to defend themselves. And so this duty of candor law is designed to push the public bodies into trying to help inquiries instead of trying to defend themselves.
Okay, can you explain the duty of candor? Does it cover individuals or does it cover bodies or agencies?
So it's orientated around the body itself. So it's the public body that must go through all its records and must give over everything that it has to the inquiry to help them to investigate. And, you know, I'm in Liverpool at the moment doing the report into the Southport killings, and we notice how critical it is really when public bodies have failed that the inquiry is able to gather as much of that information together to try and work out how to stop similar things happening again.
One would assume that any individual would tell the truth at an inquiry into a tragedy or an incident of some kind. Isn't it rather alarming to even begin to acknowledge the fact that clearly some people were prepared to lie through their teeth to protect themselves or others?
Yes, I mean, my experience of public inquiries is less of people actually lying, but more of people kind of obfuscating or trying to downplay certain issues instead of trying to be, you know, frankly honest about what's gone wrong. And the problem with that approach, in all honesty, is that it delays the moment of reckoning. I mean, really, you want people to start acknowledging what's gone wrong at an early stage. And if they're waiting for, say, criminal proceedings to go through and then for a public inquiry and then for the report before they ever start to address those problems, then you can be waiting a long time. And in the meantime, of course, a similar event may have happened again, and sometimes does.
Tell us how all this is of such significance in the Manchester Arena bombing. So many young lives lost in that terrible incident, and the families really did believe that the security services could and should have done much more.
Yes, so the Manchester Arena bombing is the most important in terms of blame for the security services themselves. And that report found that there was a critical report that had come into MI5, in fact, two critical reports, and that certainly the first of those should have been treated more seriously by MI5, and had they done so, they might have prevented the attack. And that was a crucial finding, really, after that inquiry. And it was something that really had not emerged and didn't emerge, in fact, in open hearings. It was something that the chairman addressed behind closed doors. So we still don't know what that information was and why it wasn't actually dealt with as seriously as it could have been. But the fact that it happened has raised very serious concerns, understandably, amongst the families that lost their young children or the parents of children that died in that.
And what can they do, those relatives? Is there anywhere they can go legally?
Well, there isn't, unfortunately, for them. And they have attempted to pursue legal avenues to get redress from MI5. And The last legal avenue open to them was the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. And in the end, that didn't give them the satisfaction that they were hoping for either. So they feel quite frustrated, I think, in that sense. Not all of them, but a number of them do, and feel that the security service has got off relatively lightly. Of course, MI5 don't feel that way. They feel they did their best, even though they fell short, and that the public criticism that's been aimed at them has shone a light on their operations and meant they've had to improve things.
So if, heaven forbid, something as diabolical as the Manchester Arena attack were to happen in the future, what do you think will happen? Is there realistically any hope of, let's say, an MI5 operative giving evidence in any potential public inquiry?
Well, I think that is a possibility. I mean, it does happen. So in the 7-7 inquiry and indeed in the Manchester Arena inquiry, there was a nominated, what they call a corporate witness. And many of these public bodies end up turning out a relatively high-ranking official to talk on behalf of the entire organisation. That, the families feel quite often, is less than satisfactory, because they really want to talk to the people who actually made the decisions and not just somebody who's read a report from somebody within their organisation and then repeats the report in open hearings. So yes, MI5 do get cross-examined in these inquiries, but the issue, I guess, is whether the actual people who made the decisions were cross-examined. And they were in Manchester, but it happened behind closed doors. And that was an element of frustration for the families.
Right. And I gather that in the future, security bosses in the security services will still be able to make a court application, so there'll be a certain amount of rigmarole involved in this, for disclosures in any potential inquiry to be either half or totally exempted.
Yes, and I guess the security services would say, well, there are some things that we just can't disclose. But I think, you know, having sat through these inquiries and talk to the families about their frustrations, I think, you know, one of the difficulties here is, you know, are people actually questioning them and saying, well, hang on a minute, could we make this public? Why does that need to be secret, et cetera, et cetera? Because, of course, the problem with secret organisations is that, you know, they tend to think everything needs to be kept secret. And sometimes the reality is that some of that material can be made public in a safe way that they haven't recognized. And so trying to move material from what they call closed to open is a critical part of that process, and having some kind of judicial oversight. But it will always, unfortunately, rely on how pushy, if you like, the lawyer or the judge is in this case, and how willing they are to accept the security services explanation. And sometimes people find that judges can be quite deferential towards the security services, and again, that can be frustrating as well.
Yes, I mean, you did reference the terrible Southport attacks, and we have already mentioned Sir Adrian Fulford's inquiry report in the programme. But, I mean, it is important to say that in the case of Rudha Kabbana, there was no ideology at work, apparently. He was simply obsessive. Well, his interest was in violence. Extreme misogynist violence was what motivated him. There were no other motivations. Is that your understanding?
Well, it depends whether you consider misogyny an ideology or not, and some people might do.
Well, perhaps we should, frankly.
Sorry?
Perhaps we should.
Well, perhaps we should, but the system says it's not an ideology. I think you and I might question that, but you're right. So, but in fact, that there he was looking at misogynistic violent material. He was looking at all sorts of violent materials, quite a lot of it kind of anti-colonial, some of it Nazi, some of it anti-Islamic. There was all kinds of material that he was looking at of a violent nature. And for that nature, for that reason, it's quite difficult to pin down whether misogyny obviously, you know, drove the attack itself, but whether that was behind the overall picture that Rudha Kabbana was experiencing online is another question. I think, you know, the lack of ideology shouldn't necessarily stop us trying to tackle people who are fixated with violence and trying to get them less fixated with it and to keep our communities safer. And I think that's the real lesson that comes out of Southport. Whether it's terrorism or not, we need to take it seriously.
Thank you, Duncan. That's Duncan Gardam, who's a security analyst and journalist.
In America, the incel movement is regarded as a domestic terrorist ideology, isn't it? And I don't know whether or not that is the exact case within our laws here, but we shall look into that. Mm. We've got some hot jacket news as well. I've made a little bit of a gear change there. Oh, in from Hussein, who is one of our favourite. The favourite.
Yeah, management figure.
Management figure, yes. And he informs us that you get a blue jacket if you win a blue at Oxford or Cambridge. So all of the boat race crews get one. You should know that.
Oh, gosh, I was at the boat race.
You are.
So much of the boat race, I've slightly forgotten. It's
forgotten that. Or you just found it slipped out of your brain in order for your brain to make way for other more liquid forms of knowledge?
I'm not prepared. What happened at the boat race stays at the boat race.
Except you were broadcasting. So
well,
it
only intermittently. Jane Mulcairn's was helming the event.
Okay, more jacket news as we get it this afternoon. Coming up, the AI model that's so dangerous it's causing urgent talks across the globe. Chris Stokel-Walker is going to tell us about that. You're listening to Times Radio, 12 minutes to 3.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Everything's computer.
Yeah. The government's cybersecurity watchdog is holding urgent meetings with banks and regulators to work out the threat posed by the latest artificial intelligence model from Anthropic. The developers of the Claude Mythos model say it's identified thousands of security flaws in every major computer operating system and web browser. Let's talk to Chris Stokel-Walker now. What does this actually mean for all of us, Chris?
Nothing good, Fee, I think is the long and the short of it, if we don't do something to deal about it. Now, there is an element here that we do need to bear in mind. These AI companies like to hype up their latest model releases. They like to say that these are significant things and that they are the best ever and that they will always change the world in every which way, but actually it does feel like we are seeing a step change here, and that in part is because of the way that the model has been trained. So previously we saw the current crop of AI models, the likes of ChatGPT and Claude that we use these days, they're around about 5.4, 5.5, depending on which model you are using. They were pretty good, but they were trained on a previous generation of AI chips, GPUs. This Claude Mythos, we believe, is the first one to be trained by a slightly more advanced version of AI chips. And because of that, Anthropic is saying it can do all of this stuff, which, yes, is a real danger, I think, if we're not careful about it.
What are we meant to make of the fact that developers now say they've identified these weaknesses in systems that they develop when they didn't feel at the time of development that there were any problems?
Well, that's a human error, I think, is the problem. And actually, you know, I've been covering tech for an awful long time now, too long. And I remember 12 years ago, almost to the day, certainly this month, there was a big issue called Heartbleed, which was a massive vulnerability that affected something like 80% of the websites on the entire internet through a very simple coding error that had been introduced by an overworked, overstretched human being. And it was the responsibility of just two people called Steve. One was called Steve Marquez, one was called Stephen Henson, to try and fix that problem before it became a big issue. You know, the reality is that the computer code that we use in everyday life through all sorts of different tools and websites, apps and services, we like to think that they are infallible and that they're generated by computers. But the reality is a lot of the stuff we rely on has been hacked together by individuals who maybe they've forgotten quite how these things work. And so it's unsurprising that there are all of these issues here. I think the problem is there's just been too many, and they've been too much into the nitty-gritty, a kind of, you know, needle in a haystack to try and find them and sort of cause issues with them. Whereas now with AI, you can do that at scale.
So we are very fearful of not being able to get the bad stuff back in the box. Is this a very clear example of exactly that?
Yeah, this one, if it is released publicly and widely, and you know, Anthropic, the makers of this model, have said that they are only releasing it to around about 40 organisations for the time being because they believe it is too strong, could become a bit of an issue. Notably, they're not the first company to do something like this. OpenAI, yonks back, even before the release of ChatGPT, unveiled a model called GPT-2, maybe sort of 6 or 7 years ago now. They actually initially said that they weren't going to release that publicly. They were going to cut it down and have a sort of nullified version of it released publicly so that they could figure out how to actually solve these issues if they arise. Mm. I think probably it's inevitable that it will get out there, though.
Of course, there's going to be human consequence along the lines with all of these developments. And actually, the OpenAI boss, Sam Altman, has had his own little bit of human consequence, hasn't he? A Molotov cocktail being thrown at his home.
Yeah, the temperature is rising a little bit around the AI world at the minute. We have, I think, the release of these really significant models that the companies themselves are saying are going to be world-changing, and we understand why they're doing so. They have to justify their multi-billion dollar valuations. We know OpenAI is thinking about launching an IPO, an initial public offering, either later this year or next year. We know SpaceX, the company developed by Elon Musk, is going to launch its IPO later this year. And then also Anthropic looks like it might do so at some point in the next 12 to 24 months. So they are having to justify this, and they are saying that they're doing significant things. The problem is there are a group of people who are very much worried about the capabilities of AI. They think that this is an existential risk, and so they are trying to do anything possible to dissuade those who are at the vanguard of developing the latest cutting-edge AI to hit the brakes. And it seems like there is there's been a couple of incidents, actually. So there was a Molotov cocktail thrown at Sam Altman's California home. We don't know whether or not he was in, but Altman has said that it shook him up with his family. He has a young child with his husband. And also overnight, we saw that there were several shots fired, again in the vicinity of Sam Altman's home. Not entirely certain what's happened there either, but I think it just shows the temperature is rising here as people start to think that these are really consequential decisions.
Sure. Finally, Chris, and I'm sad to say that we haven't got any good news this week.
No.
You've been writing about a fake disease that AI insists is real. Tell us about this one.
Bixonomania. If you are someone who has spent too long on your laptop or your phone staring at a screen all day, you have itchy eyes and perhaps you end up with pink skin around there, very, very much sensitive. Then if you had typed in those symptoms to an AI chatbot within the last couple of years, it may well have told you that you had this illness called Bixonomania. Now, that is not true, not medically accurate, no way, shape or form is it actually a thing. You probably just have dry eyes and the pink skin something else entirely, probably wouldn't get it anyway. It was the invention of a researcher in Sweden who wanted to see how easy it is to poison these AI models' outputs by just simply telling them false stuff and seeing how quickly it could spread. So in April 2024, she put in a couple of blog posts onto the internet and also a couple of fake AI-generated scientific bits of research that she uploaded, and then saw what happened and how it all spooled out. And the reality is that, unfortunately, an awful lot of AI models were regurgitating this idea, this diagnosis of buxonomania, and also doing it, by the way, because a lot of the scientific community did not read the papers that were produced and ended up regurgitating them, citing them as if they were real.
It's so worrying, because actually she also planted lots of clues, didn't she, to the fact that this wasn't a real disease, including saying that one of the original papers was funded by the Professor Sideshow Bob Foundation for its work in advanced trickery, part of a larger funding initiative from the University of Fellowship of the Ring and Galactic Triad.
Yeah, there was a whole range of different references in there. So we've got Lord of the Rings, we've got The Simpsons. There was also a credit in there to Professor Maria Boehm at the Starfleet Academy for her help and generosity aboard the USS Enterprise. So I think that's a Star Trek reference as well. There was also a segment in this paper which literally said this entire paper is made up, and it surveyed 50 made up individuals who were recruited for the experiment. So, you know, I think it's a consequence here of several things. One is that worry around AI. The other, I think, is this idea that we're no longer reading or consuming the stuff that's being put in front of us. Instead, we're asking AI to do it for us. And the reality is, this is the kind of thing that we need to always remember. AI doesn't think for itself. When it was created as a concept, you know, some 70 years ago, it was really the original sin. Calling it anything to do with intelligence is a bit of a misnomer, even if it is developing at a pretty high speed.
Well, we just need to stay unbelievably vigilant, don't we? And keep our wary spectacles on when we're reading anything from AI, and check in with you every week, Chris. That's all we can hope for.
Help with the bixonomania as well if you wear your glasses. So.
Yeah, very much so. It's always lovely to talk to you. That's Chris Stokel-Walker. If there's anything that you'd like him to investigate on your behalf, you're very welcome to drop us an email, janeandfee@times.radio. Sometimes he does manage to find for us the glory bits of this new interface of humans and technology. Just not this week, Jane.
Let's celebrate Jim, who sent us a lovely image of his hair transplant. He went to Budapest for two hair transplants and tooth surgery, he says. Wonderful city, great for health and vanity tourism from the UK. I've attached a photo of my hair, but not my teeth. He's currently in his camper van. It looks like a very sunny day in Somerset. And your hair looks mighty fine.
But what about your teeth, Jim? I'd like to see them.
Well, we could be blinded by them. Well, that's turkey teeth. Oh, I've just shot my pen lid across the desk. Maybe Hungarian teeth are a little bit more circumspect. Who knows? Show us, Jim.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
No other images of plastic surgery, please. Can I make that very clear?
Did you think you'd come to work today and ask a random stranger to show you his teeth?
Oh, what? Well, there's nothing new here. 3 o'clock, it's Jane and Fee on Times Radio. In the next hour, the American blockade of the already blockaded Strait of Hormuz begins now. What will that change? Well, we'll talk to a former US diplomat who was able to come to an agreement with the Iranians. Vassos is here with his sporting bit, including how Rory McIlroy overcame his own errors and his opposition to win the Masters again. An amazing triumph, that, actually, a great achievement. We'll also talk books with the Times Literary Team, and Adam Shaw, our personal finance man, will tell us about our new employment rights. That's all after the news at 3 on Times Radio with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. A US blockade of maritime traffic using Iranian ports has come into force, with the military issuing a capture warning to vessels attempting to break it. Tehran says American restrictions on international waters amount to piracy, warning no port in the Persian Gulf or Gulf of Oman will be safe while Iran's are under threat. Sir Keir Starmer insisted Britain will not get dragged into the war, adding his priority remains the reopening of the Hormuz Strait. Chief Executive of Vespucci Maritime, Lars Jensen, told Times Radio the blockade will have a limited impact.
The reality is the Iranians have done a bang-up job at blocking the Hormuz Strait already. which means that 90-95% of traffic has already been halted for 6 weeks. If the US goes ahead and enforces the blockade they talk about, sure, that will block a few of the Iranian vessels that still ply the strait, but it is a small fraction of the overall blockage that we already see. So from a global perspective, a US blockade of Iranian ships to Iranian ports is a minor event.
Meanwhile, Pope Leo says he'll continue to speak out against war despite Donald Trump's scathing attack overnight. The US president accused the pontiff of being weak on crime and terrible for foreign policy. Pope Leo said he didn't want to get into a debate with Mr. Trump. The Southport inquiries found the murders of three girls at a dance class in July 2024 could and should have been prevented. Alistair Silva Aguirre, Elsie Dot Stancombe and Bibi King were killed during a knife attack at a Taylor Swift-themed workshop. Inquiry chair Sir Adrian Fulford found there was a fundamental failure by multiple agencies to manage the risk Axel Rudakabana posed. He said the killer's parents also bear significant responsibility for not reporting concerns. The Times' chief political commentator Patrick Maguire is from Southport and has been following the inquiry.
This is a new kind of offending, you know, and it's really hard to compute in its depravity because it's almost without precedent. You know, it's just this extreme nihilistic violence for its own sake, not necessarily in service of any ideology or political aim, just wanting to inflict pain and being obsessed with violence and hurting people. Sort of nihilistic violence perpetrated by often very young men.
Hungary's new prime minister says he'll try to make his country free, European, functioning and humane. Peter Maggia says he'll work every day and every hour of the day to improve Hungary's security and development. The Sunday Times' Europe editor Peter Conradi says Hungarians voted with their purses and wallets.
The main issue in the election, ultimately, according to all the analysis I've seen, was the cost of living crisis and essentially the way that Peter Maggia managed to link it with corruption. The other factor is that Orbán has been in power for a very long time, 16 years, and there was a real desire for change. You know, yes, geopolitics played a part, but I think not as much as one would have thought.
Nearly 100 criminal investigations have been launched during the last year into suspected rule-breaking by England's water companies. The Environment Agency says it's examined issues including illegal sewage leaks and poorly maintained treatment facilities. The Environment Secretary Emma Reynolds says underperforming and polluting firms have nowhere to hide. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So we'll go straight into the news at 3:04. The US blockade of the Strait of Hormuz is now in force, having started officially at 3:00. Iran has also blocked the strait to ships during the conflict in the Middle East, but its own tankers have continued to use it. Sir Keir Starmer says the UK will not be joining any blockade.
We're not supporting the blockade, and all of the marshalling diplomatically, politically and capability. We do have minesweeping capability. I won't go into operational matters, but we do have that capability. That's all focused from our point of view on getting the straits fully open. I want to be really clear about that. And the reason for that is because that's the way we get energy prices down as quickly as possible.
Well, the French President Emmanuel Macron says the UK and France will work together to form a coalition aimed at restoring freedom of navigation in the Strait. Let's talk now to Alan Eyre, who's an expert on Iran, a former US diplomat, and was a key member of the American negotiating team for the 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran. He is now a distinguished diplomatic fellow with the Middle East Institute. Alan Eyre, a very good afternoon for us. We are really thrilled to have you on the programme. I wonder what you think of this latest development and the American blockade that we've now had for 5 minutes.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Fee. I mean, I think it's a sign of the increasing desperation from the U.S. administration. If the idea in blocking Iranian ports, and let's be clear, this is not a blockade of the strait. We want ships back and forth through the strait. It's a blockade of all ships going to and from any Iranian port. But if the idea is to increase pain on Iran so it capitulates to U.S. demands, that's not going to happen. Okay, Iran, the blockade of the Iranian ports is going to be inflationary because it'll take barrels off the international oil market. It's too slow acting on Iran to have any practical effect. It's going to increase uncertainty about ships transiting the Strait of Hormuz. And so it's really not that effective. It's also going to be escalatory because there's a good case that if the U.S. tries to, for example, seize a Chinese ship, a Pakistan ship, that could lead to further problems.
What would you have done? Were you still part of a negotiating team? And perhaps if we can imagine that you were there by J.D. Vance's side in Pakistan.
At that point, it was almost too late. I mean, the vase was already broken. The egg was pretty. I mean, you can't. Some things you just can't walk back. But if I were to counsel J.D. Vance and the U.S. administration, I would say this. Your prime goal is to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon. But the demands you are making of Iran, and they are demands because the U.S. is showing very little negotiating flexibility, are too hard. You can still get what you want, but you can't insist on zero enrichment on Iranian soil, Iran exporting all its enriched uranium, and the dissembling of Iran's nuclear plants. So, but you don't have to. You can get a deal much like the one we did with JCPOA, which still prevents Iran from having a nuclear weapon. But the danger is the U.S. seems to be locked into this maximalist position on the nuclear issue.
But if back in 2015 you imagined that you had secured a deal that meant that Iran was not going to have a nuclear weapon, you know, we find ourselves in 2026 with a U.S. administration and many, many other administrations around the world simply not believing that to be true. So in a sense, that agreement didn't hold. Something did have to happen now.
That's factually suspect in that the agreement didn't hold because the United States unilaterally ripped it up and pulled out of it, even though the Iranians were still living up to it, according to even U.S. certification. So you're right. It's a very different world now in 2026 after two military strikes by the U.S. and Israel on Iran in the last year. But had we not exited unilaterally the JCPOA in 2015, we might not well be where we are right now with the global economy slowly spinning out of control because of Iran's chokehold on the Strait of Hormuz.
We think that some of the language that is being used by President Trump is just extraordinary. We're not alone in that, Mr. Eyre. And I wonder what your thoughts are about the use of swear words, the use of destruction of civilizations, phrases like that. I mean, the art of diplomacy just doesn't contain that, does it?
No, again, as a U.S. citizen, I'm embarrassed by the language my own president is using. At best, it's intemperate hyperbole, and at worst, the speech themselves are war crimes threatening to destroy civilization, destroy civilian infrastructure. So, yeah, this U.S. administration has shown it's not serious about sustained negotiations. President Trump seems to think he can bludgeon reality by using hyperbole and profanity and social media at all hours of the day. That's not going to happen. The only thing that can solve this issue, it isn't going to be the U.S. military. It's going to be sustained diplomacy. And even that might not be sufficient at this point.
So what would your advice be to Keir Starmer? And is it relevant what Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron are trying to do? Will it realistically make that much difference to a diplomatic situation at the moment?
I think the UK and all the rest of the countries, to include China, need to add their input and their pressure on Iran to get Iran to relinquish control of the Strait of Hormuz. With this realization, there's not enough stick to get Iran to walk back on this, to capitulate, to surrender. There needs to be some sort of incentive for Iran, because Iran, in its mind, is fighting for its life, doesn't want to be attacked every 6 months to a year by the United States, and needs some sort of revenue stream to make up for the billions and billions of destruction that it has endured. So I would counsel the UK and China and the rest of the international community to fill in the diplomatic gap that the U.S. has left open by its own inability to engage in serious negotiations.
Just with regard to China, Mr. It's being threatened by even higher tariffs, isn't it? Because Donald Trump believes that the country is helping to supply weapons to Iran. So where does that leave China's position diplomatically?
China has a very strong hand. It is right. China is helping Iran. It's to some extent. They've even said they're going to supply man pads, which are essential for reconstituting Iran's destroyed air defense. But if you're looking at countries that have the ability to sway Iran, China is at the top of the list. Almost all of Iran's oil exports go to China. They have a strategic agreement. So when China talks, Iran listens. The same is true to a lesser extent with the Gulf countries, but China has a unique role to play in trying to get the two sides to move toward an agreement. But let's not also forget that the deal breaker in all of this is Israel, which wants to continue attacks on Iran and bring Iran to failed state status.
Can we also talk about the domestic audience that President Trump is trying to play to? Now, there are recent polls that suggest that even the MAGA base, which did seem to be accommodating to this intervention in the Middle East, is really starting to lose any appetite for this at all. And obviously, the US can only endure high oil prices and disturbed markets for so long. I mean, this is a very, very unpredictable president, but I'm going to ask you to try and predict what his move might be towards his own people over the coming weeks and months.
Well, you're quite right, Fee. President Trump's popularity is cratering across every part of the demographic, and this is heading into important midterm congressional elections in November. And he's very conscious of that. What the rest other world leaders think about what he's doing, not that important to him. But the domestic political reality is something he's finally attuned to. So that's one of the reasons why he sought to cease fire, was because the effects of the prolonged closure of the strait are really starting to manifest in the United States. That's only going to get worse. So the only real pressure on President Trump to fix the mess he's created comes from domestic political realities, and he's keeping a very close eye on those.
And what happens kind of practically on that front? I mean, does there have to be a figurehead within the MAGA movement and close to the top of the Republican tree who stands up and says, okay, coalesce around me in order for Trump to change direction? He's not a guy who wants to lose face, and there just doesn't seem to be that person who's kind of, you know, putting their head above the parapet at the moment.
Yes, one of the unique accomplishments of President Trump is that he totally controls the U.S. Congress, at least the Republicans who have the majority. So no one in the Congress from the Republican side is going to push back. He also has a cabinet, a yes-man cabinet, that praises him and never really gives any pushback. So that's one of the problems, is there's no one to tell President Trump what he needs to hear. Within the MAGA party, yes, one of the reasons many voted for him was because he promised not to get us involved in these forever foreign wars, and now he's done just that. So he's losing at least part of his base. He's conscious of that, and he's conscious that if he doesn't get things at least on a better trajectory, then he most certainly will lose the House and could possibly even lose the Senate, which would be a big deal come November.
Some of our listeners have also pointed out that they don't quite understand why the Republican movement that bases itself in strong Christian moral values isn't more outraged by the kind of behaviour that we saw over the Easter weekend, where Donald Trump posted this extraordinary AI image of him as Jesus curing a man. He's now embroiled in a pretty open feud with the Pope. Why isn't that stirring things up more?
Again, if you're asking me to explain why President Trump has such a hold on the Democratic Party and why his supporters continue to support him in the midst of felony convictions, infidelities, inanities, absurdities. I can't. I mean, I just know as a practical political matter, any Republican congressperson who moves against him will be threatened in primaries on the right by someone Trump supports. But what's interesting now is it looks like President Trump's support, his political support, has less and less weight. So we might well see some Republicans who realize after the November elections he's going to be a lame duck president anyway. We might see some Republicans poke their head up above the parapets and start giving at least tepid criticisms of President Trump. We'll see.
And let's return to your area of expertise, which is Iran, Mr. Eyre. And I wonder whether you've got any insights you could share with us as to who it might be who would be able to stand up and realistically become some kind of figurehead for people who don't want the current regime. The Iranian regime constantly wants to tell us that there isn't anybody there, but that's simply not true, is it?
Well, here's the reality about opposition to the Islamic Republic of Iran regime. There are tremendous numbers of brave, committed oppositionists, both inside Iran and outside Iran. Unfortunately, there is no organized and effective opposition either inside or outside Iran. So there's no alternative on the shelf. This is one of the many reasons why regime change didn't work, because there's no regime to change to. But given time, I think that a domestic opposition can become organized and effective, much like it's done before. We've seen increasing protest inside Iran over the last couple of years. So, but the bad news is that our attack and this war set that back and put in place a more militarized and hardline Iranian government and regime that's going to be even more ruthless in suppressing domestic opposition. So for the time being, there are a lot of civil leaders in Iran. Almost all of them are in prison. But Iran continues to bungle running its own country, this regime, and that's going to have consequences sooner or later, I would hope.
Very good to have your thoughts this afternoon. Thank you for your time. That's Alan Eyre, expert on Iran, a key member of the American negotiating team back in 2015 and a distinguished diplomatic fellow with the Middle East Institute.
And a number of media outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, are now reporting that a US judge has dismissed a case against the publisher of the Wall Street Journal over that story. Do you remember the story about the so-called birthday book? For Jeffrey Epstein.
With the cartoon in it.
Yeah, allegedly etched by one Donald J. Trump. Anyway, a US judge has dismissed a case against the Wall Street Journal over a story about ties the US president had to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Trump had sued the American newspaper and its owners, including Rupert Murdoch, in a Florida federal court last summer. He wanted $10 billion in damages. The president claimed the newspaper had defamed him. Trump said it was a fake thing. He denied doing the cartoon, the little drawing. But U.S. District Judge Darren Gales said Trump came nowhere close to showing that the Wall Street Journal had acted with actual malice towards him. Apparently, Donald Trump will be allowed to file a new amended lawsuit if he chooses to. And he's got until just about the end of April to do so. More trouble for the Trump household. Next on Times Radio, how did Rory McIlroy do it, overcome stiff opposition and win that green jacket again? And as Tim points out, Jane and Fee, a rather grand friend of mine, always corrects me when I refer to jackets. He says they're not jackets, they're coats. Potatoes have jackets.
Have we been very vulgar and very common?
I think we've been extraordinarily low class. Sorry about that. Tim's grand friend. It's 21 minutes past three, Times Radio.
The State of It USA is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight.
I went out on the road this week with the First Lady and we rode back in the motorcade.
No fake news, no flag waving and no Trump derangement syndrome. Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
The Story. The award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
All eyes turn to North America this June. Well, not just North America, because it's Mexico as well, isn't it? That's not North America, is it?
Central.
Thank you. It's the biggest World Cup in history. 48 teams, three host nations, one massive question. Who's going to win the Men's World Cup in New York on what will be a glorious day for England? Is it July the 19th? I've already put it in my diary. I think it's July the 19th.
Have you? That is optimistic.
Ever the optimist.
Very good.
On May the 26th, join the Times top football team, Tom Clark, Martin Samuel and Jonathan Northcroft for an unmissable preview. They'll give you the expert's edge before the first whistle blurts across the Men's World Cup in the summer. It starts in June, doesn't it? For tickets, just head to thetimes.com/events. You may have gathered that Vassos is here to talk sport. And actually, congratulations to Rory McIlroy, only the fourth man ever to win back-to-back Masters titles. He beat Justin Rose of England, Scotty Scheffler of the States, to this coveted green jacket. How hard is the Masters relative to other golf tournaments? I'm not an expert. I don't know.
It's one of those courses that if it suits your game, it suits your game. It's
right.
It looks absolutely immaculate. On Thursday, Rick Broadbent was writing in the Times, and he described Augusta with its traditions and its perfect. I mean, they dye the lakes blue, they colour in the divots on the fairway green so that it all looks absolutely perfect. I think he said it's something like it's a Truman Show. It's the best bubble in sport, he said. A Truman Show with azaleas. And generally, I think golf could do with a bit less of all of that. Mm. But we forget Wimbledon, we forgive Wimbledon its Wimbledonness, and we actually forgive Augusta its Augustaness. I do wish there was a Women's Masters as well, to be honest, a professional
Isn't
event.
The...
No, there's an amateur event, but there's not a sort of big, prestigious, it's not one of the five women's majors. It's one of the four men's majors. It's the first one to come every year, and it's the one played at the same course every year.
Oh, okay. So it just doesn't vary at all.
So it doesn't vary. The winner wins a green jacket, which the first time he wins, he's allowed to carry with him everywhere. So this time last year, after Rory McIlroy, a decade in the making, had finally won the Grand Slam, as they call it, the fourth of the four men's majors that he hadn't won before, and it was a tough old decade getting there. He threw away a few, you know, the pressure got to him, and then he finally came through last year in a playoff against Justin Rose, and then he did the talk show rounds in America, and he recreated when he was a 7-year-old in Northern Ireland. He appeared on BBC Northern Ireland on a chat show, chipping golf balls into his mum's washing machine, because that's how he used to practice, and he'd recreate that in the green jacket. But now he's won it again. He's not. It's only the first time you win it, you're allowed to take it with you. After that, you have to leave it there.
It's a strange rule.
There are lots of strange rules. If you go, if you're one of the spectators, you're not allowed to be called a spectator. You have to be called a patron. If you are one of the patrons, you are not allowed a mobile phone. You are not allowed to run. And so they do this sort of speed walk when they're allowed in, when the gates open at 7 a.m. or 5 a.m. or whatever it is every morning. And they also don't have any merchandise for sale online. So there are these ludicrous Masters gnomes for sale at $60 that you're only allowed one per person, but then you sell it online for $600 per person per gnome. So it's a very curious. I quite like it. It's a very curious event, the Masters Golf. And
I think they've just had too many committees there.
I think so.
That's just an awful lot of people who've had time to fill, and they've really filled it.
I mean, they really have.
Yeah, I'd like to see their rule book. Not.
It's just a lot going down, isn't it?
I mean, there is a... I mean, it was only 10... 12 years ago, they allowed women to be members at the Augusta National Golf Club. The thing is, not even that old. You know, they can't sort of say, you know, well, 300 years of tradition. There's only about nine. I think it was the 90th. And I know it was the 90th Masters. So it's not even a century old. But they do. They have their traditions. They have the flowers that absolutely perfectly bloom. And it all looks beautiful on television. They don't really have. So, again, Owen Slott, who went and was writing in the Times this morning, was saying that, you know, when Rory McIlroy, he had a two-shot lead coming down the final hole. So you're thinking, Rory, at least this time you can't mess it up. And then he swipes his driver off the 18th and it goes miles right, almost into the next state, whatever is next to Georgia. That's where it went. And so the people on the green, Owen included, didn't know because they saw his playing partner in the middle of the fairway where he should be. But they've not got radio commentary really at Augusta. They old school, you know, school like the old school, they'll say. And so they didn't know where Rory McIlroy was. They're sort of the only clue was that some of the patrons on the right hand side of the fair were being asked to move, and then suddenly from the undergrowth emerges Rory McIlroy, who'd managed to sort of miraculously play a shot next to the green, and then he used all the shots that he had in the bag. Having looked halfway through the tournament, like, oh, the monkey's off my back. Yeah. I'm playing completely relaxed golf. I'm going to lap the field. He was six shots clear. No one in the history of the Masters had been six shots clear at the halfway stage. Gave that all away on Saturday, then gave the lead away on Sunday, and then somehow sort of scrambled to a win. He does it Rory way, and we sort of love that about him. He is one of the good guys, Rory McIlroy.
Justin Rose, isn't he one of the good guys? I like him.
Very much one of the good guys.
And he's not won this, has he?
No, he hasn't. And he's come second twice, losing to Ryder Cup teammates in two playoffs. So, you know, last year he was thrilled for Rory McIlroy, who's a great friend of his, but obviously gutted for himself. And you felt that he'd spent the whole year, the commentator said as much, that he'd spent the whole year just thinking, right, I'm going to put that right. He's 45, 46 years old, Justin Rose, but he has a sort of a mobile home that comes with him, which has got all the full wellness. You know, it's got the infrared saunas, it's got the Theraguns. You know, he's fully woo-wooed up in all of the modern kind of life extending, fitness extending things, and he looks great. And the one person that you wouldn't say is going to throw it away because it's difficult because of bottle would be Justin Rose, and he was leading by two at the halfway stage yesterday and snatched at a few putts, missed a few easy chips, and yeah, I'm afraid he came third equal, and it would have been lovely to see. I was rooting for Rory McIlroy, and if there's one person in the entire 91-person field that I'd have liked to have won it more than Rory, it would have been Justin Rose.
Michael takes issue with you. Where did you find this ghastly cynic? Asks Michael.
I'm not a cynic.
Augusta is special and enjoyed by many. Your friend has never been invited, I suspect. Well, you've been, haven't you?
I was a member for many years of the BBC golf team, so yes. I have. And
yeah, Michael's been.
It is wonderful. It's wonderful. I did say, you know, I think golf needs less of that sort of stuff, but you forgive Augusta. It is like the best bubble, like Rick Broadbent said, in sport.
I think it's probably me who's been the cynic with my challenge about the committees having too much time. I don't think that's at Vassos. I think that's aimed at me.
I don't know. I think you probably have a point.
Okay, it's kind of you.
And as we're all apologising for everything, but mainly me, Mexico is, of course, in North America, isn't it?
Is it?
Well, Sue says it is. And talking of people who can't win things, Arsenal. What a shame. They lost to Bournemouth on Saturday at home, and I was just at the station. I was at King's Cross Station on Saturday afternoon. There were lots of little kids in their Arsenal shirts and lots of very, very depressed-looking people.
I know.
What is it? It's just they just can't get there,
they
might still win it, I suppose.
They are Rory McIlroy trying to win the Masters until last year when he finally got over the line but tried to give it away a few times. And maybe Arsenal are doing their Rory McIlroy trying to give it away a few times, and then they will cross the line first. They go to Manchester City, who won yesterday at Chelsea, and so that's basically the title decider. It all comes down to, well, they're saying, you know, it all comes down to next Sunday, and obviously there's more matches, five more matches after that to go. But Arsenal, yes, it's that home ground where everybody is like gurning and they're just so worried about everything and they just can't play with any sort of fluency. Since we last were mildly amused by Arsenal giving stuff away, they have lost in the FA Cup to Southampton. They've lost the league. I mean, they could have won the quadruple. They've lost the League Cup final, didn't turn up against Manchester City. And now they've lost to Bournemouth at home. They just, this is the time of year that Arsenal give it away, and Arsenal are giving it away again. And could they come second this year in a one-horse race, essentially, for the fourth season in a row? Their fans would be desperately hoping not. But it looks like all momentum is with Manchester City, who played pretty, I mean, it was like a, I don't know, it seemed like a sort of training game in the first half at Stamford Bridge yesterday. And I don't know what Pep Guardiola said, but they came out with a bit between their teeth in the second half, scored three good goals. And yeah, and now the pressure is firmly on Arsenal. If Manchester City beat them next week, then Manchester City are firm favourites for the title.
Well, Vassos, after that bruising couple of minutes for our North London listeners, we say farewell to you. I'll see you tomorrow.
I mean, the Spurs, but, you know, the Spurs listeners might have enjoyed it a little bit more. Mind you, they lost again.
Yeah, and they're not in a great place either. Yeah. We've got some soothing book talk coming your way, everybody, so please don't worry. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first. It's 32 minutes past three. Here's James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Southport inquiries found the murders of three girls at a dance class in July 2024 wouldn't have happened if the killer's parents had reported their son. Chair Sir Adrian Fulford said Axel Rudikabana's actions were repeatedly excused, which led to a failure to address the teenager's dangerous behaviours.
I have no doubt that if appropriate procedures had been in place and if sensible steps had been taken by the agencies and AR's parents, it could have been and it should have been prevented.
67 recommendations have been made, including potential powers to restrict or monitor internet access for young people posing a risk to others. Donald Trump's planned blockade of the Strait of Hormuz has now come into effect. In the past few moments, he's warned Iranian ships will be eliminated. The UK government says its forces will not be involved, despite the president claiming British minesweepers would be used. Meanwhile, Pope Leo says he'll continue to speak out against war, despite Mr. Trump's scathing attack overnight. The US president accused the pontiff of being weak on crime and terrible for foreign policy. Hungary's incoming prime minister says he wants it to be a European country again. Peter Madger defeated the far-right leader Viktor Orban in yesterday's election. A judge has dismissed Donald Trump's $10 billion lawsuit against the Wall Street Journal over reporting on his ties to Jeffrey Epstein. District Judge Darren B. Gales in Florida found the president had failed to make the argument that the article was published with the intent to be malicious. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
There is a land steeped in ancient history, myth and legend, where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. This spring, start your own story in Scotland. From wild mountain ranges to bustling cities, witness Scotland bloom into life this spring. Explore its dramatic landscapes and uncover our ancient Celtic roots. Experience vast lochs, majestic glens and lofty mountains, all easily accessible from our many vibrant cities and towns. Scotland is the perfect place to find yourself. Whether you're looking for scenic hikes or a stay in a cosy cottage, there's something for every type of traveller in Scotland. And with an exciting range of festivals and sporting and cultural events to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
at Times Radio. Susie Goldsborough, some highfalutin book chat in a moment. But first of all, my colleague Fee Glover will be Donald Trump, who's just posted on Truth Social about the new US blockade of Iranian ports.
He says Iran's navy is laying at the bottom of the sea, completely obliterated 158 ships. What we have not hit are their small number of what they call fast attack ships, because we did not consider them much of a threat. Warning, if any of these ships come anywhere close to our blockade, that's in caps, they will be immediately eliminated, that's in caps, using the same system of kill that we use against the drug dealers on boats at sea. It's quick and brutal. P.S. 98.2% of drugs coming into the US by ocean or sea have stopped, in caps. Thank you for your attention to this matter, President DJT. So you're updated there. Time to calm down, deep breath, enter our literary
sound. Let's talk about books.
Let's talk about books. We welcome Susie Goldsborough, Deputy Literary Editor of The Times and Sunday Times. Thank God you're here.
Bringing the levity, I hope.
Yes, well, and also just bringing the culture and bringing the highbrow and the lowbrow all at the same time. Let's talk about Flesh, which is the Booker Prize winning novel by David Sully that tells a rags to riches story about a young Hungarian man called István. Now, there's just a bit of a story that's been hanging over this book since its publication, which has got a little bit more wind in its sails. Tell us more.
Yeah, it's this interesting story that the plot of Flesh bears some striking resemblances to the celebrated Stanley Kubrick film Barry Lyndon. The idea of a kind of young a young man who starts off without much in the world and then joins the army, marries a rich woman, and then it all kind of goes terribly wrong. Various plot points that chart onto the movie. And although you know, that kind of arc, we could say, takes place in several different novels, there are some more overt references to the movie in the book. There's like a particular line of dialogue that seems to have been lifted straight. And a few people have pointed this out. The odd thing is that the author has not kind of accepted that the parallels are there, which I think is why the story has a bit of wind in its sails. But other people have pointed out that this is not unusual. I mean, great literature pays homage to great art all the time. And yeah, perhaps it's slightly unusual he hasn't acknowledged the parallels, but I think this is a bit of a non-story.
Well, let's leave it there. Let's talk about other things. Let's discuss what you've been reading. Permanence by Sophie McIntosh. Tell us about this one.
Yes, so I was put onto this by my colleague on the books, Laura Hackett. Sophie McIntosh, listeners might have read or heard of her before. She's a bit of a young literary thing. Her first novel, The Water Cure, was longlisted for the Booker a few years ago. She writes what Laura calls chic dystopias, which I think is quite a good description. They tend to be set in sort of strange alternative realities where there's one where three women have been isolated to keep them safe from men. There's one where two different women have to, every woman has to is given a ticket at birth to kind of decide whether she's going to have children or not. These kind of feminist dystopias, interesting stuff. This Permanence is definitely, I think, her most kind of accessible, her most mainstream. It's about a couple who are having an affair. He's married, she's not, but they're having a secret affair. They wake up one morning in this strange alternative city. It's kind of beautiful, idealized city to me, although, I mean, it sounds absolutely beautiful. It also sounds quite a lot like Hackney, lots of small plate restaurants. It turns out that it's full of cheating couples. If you're a cheating couple, you end up in this alternate city where you can live your life in the open freely, but of course you're kind of cut off from the world, you're trapped there. So it raises this kind of interesting moral questions. How would you rather escape from your life with your secret lover or sort of go back and face reality? So it's quite a fun high concept premise.
Okay, does it have a happy ending?
She doesn't really do happy.
Okay.
And there aren't a lot of jokes in it. I do want to caution people. It's sort of impressively humorless.
Right.
But it is fun.
It sounds like a nightmare version of the world where you've only got cheating couples and small plates. I mean, that's my idea of hell.
Well, I think that's what the characters kind of decide by the end. So you've understood it there.
Okay. And on the small plates, there's going to be some hispy cabbage, isn't there?
Oh, for sure. There's a lot of skin contact wine, a lot of hispy cabbage.
Okay. Now,
Oh, no, not yet. OK, I've just got some instructions in my ear, but we can't go to it yet. We are going to bring you what Keir Starmer is saying in the House of Commons. He's making a statement on the Middle East, but we're not going to go to it just yet. So here's a challenge at any moment, Sophie. I will interrupt you, but you're going to start telling us about Heart the Lover by Lily King.
OK, Heart the Lover by Lily King.
We need to go. So here is Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. With permission, I'd like to update the House on my visit to the Gulf, the evolving situation in the Middle East, and the implications for Britain's security. But before I do that, I want to put on record in this House my total determination to make the changes across the entire state that are so clearly necessary to honour the victims, the injured, and the families of Southport. Yeah. Today's report, Mr. Speaker, is harrowing. It is difficult to read, and I cannot begin to imagine the pain upon pain that will cause the families that it affects. And our thoughts are with them today. Yeah. And the Home Secretary will respond to the report in full, Mr. Speaker, after this statement. Mr. Speaker, last week I visited the Gulf, and I was able to thank in person some of the brave men and women who from day one of the US-Iran conflict have resolutely defended the interests of this country, its people and its partners. I thank them again, Mr. Speaker, in this House for their courage and their service, and I'm sure the whole House will join me in those thanks. Mr. Speaker, whilst in the Gulf, I met leaders and senior military representatives across the region, including the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, the President of the UAE, the King and Crown Prince of Bahrain, the Emir and Prime Minister of Qatar, and in recent days I've also spoken to the Sultan of Oman and the Emir of Kuwait. Across all of these conversations, I agreed to deepen our engagement on both defence and economic resilience. Because, Mr. Speaker, they all made it abundantly clear that the solidarity and strength of our partnership with them has been a comfort in these challenging times. And we should not forget that the nature of Iran's response, the indiscriminate attack upon countries who never sought this conflict, the huge damage done across the Gulf to civilian infrastructure with civilian casualties is abhorrent. It has clearly shocked the region and all of us. And we must bear that in mind now as we lift our sights to the future. Because whilst the ceasefire between the US, Israel and Iran is undeniably welcome, it is also highly fragile. The region remains on edge and a lot of work is required to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, to de-escalate the situation leading to a sustainable ceasefire. In pursuit of that goal, we call for Lebanon to be included urgently in the ceasefire. Diplomacy is the right path, and I welcome the talks taking place this week. Hezbollah must disarm, but I'm equally clear Israel's strikes are wrong. They are having devastating humanitarian consequences and pushing Lebanon into a crisis. The bombing should stop now. Mr. Speaker, we also put on record our thanks to Pakistan and other partners for playing such an important role in diplomatic efforts. We hope the process will continue without further escalation. And that applies to the running sore that is the Strait of Hormuz, shamefully exploited by Iran. All of the leaders that I met were crystal clear that freedom of navigation is vital and must be restored. No conditions, no tolls, and no tolerance of Iran holding the world's economy to ransom. Because, Mr. Speaker, the impact of Iran's behaviour in the Strait is causing untold economic damage. It's visible on every petrol forecourt in the country. My guide from the start of this conflict has always been our national interest. That's why we stayed out of the war and why we continue to stay out of the war. And that is why we are working now to restore freedom of navigation in the Middle East, because that is squarely in our national interest. Now, Mr. Speaker, quite clearly, this is not a straightforward task. It will take time. I met UK businesses in energy, shipping, insurance and finance, and they are clear that vessels will not be put through the strait until they are confident that it's safe to do so. And that's why we're working around the clock on a credible plan to reopen the strait. And, Mr. Speaker, I can confirm today that together with President Macron, I will convene a summit of leaders this week to drive forward the international effort we have built in recent weeks, bringing together dozens of countries to ensure freedom of navigation in the Strait of Hormuz. The summit will be focused on two things. First, diplomatic efforts to bring pressure to bear for a negotiated end to the conflict and for the strait to be opened. Second, military planning to provide assurance to shipping as soon as a stable environment can be established. And let me be very clear, this is about safeguarding shipping and supporting freedom of navigation once the conflict ends. Our shared aim here is a coordinated, independent, multinational plan. This is the moment, Mr. Speaker, for clear and calm leadership. And notwithstanding the difficulties, Britain stands ready to play our part. Mr. Speaker, let me now return to the impact of this conflict on our economy. We all know that the consequences will be significant, and that they will last longer than the conflict itself. Now, we continue to monitor the effects, and I remind the House that energy bills went down on the 1st of April, and whatever happens in the Middle East, those bills will stay down until July. We're investing over £50 million to support heating oil customers, and fuel duty is frozen until September, all because of the decisions that this government took at the budget. But, Mr. Speaker, there's a wider point, because we can't stand here in this House and pretend that a global shock threatening to hit the living standards of British people is somehow a novel experience. Britain has been buffeted by crises for decades now, from the 2008 financial crash through austerity, Brexit, COVID, the war that still rages in Ukraine, and the disastrous premiership of Liz Truss. The response each time has been to try to return to the status quo. A status quo, Mr. Speaker, that manifestly failed working people who saw their living standards flatline and their public services decimated. So this time, Britain's response must and will be different to reflect the changing world that we live in. That starts with our economic security, where during this conflict alone, we've capped energy bills, raised the living wage, strengthened workers' rights and ended the two-child limit that will lift nearly 500,000 children out of poverty. But, Mr. Speaker, looking forward, it also means a closer economic relationship with our European allies. Because Brexit did deep damage to the economy. And the opportunities we now have to strengthen our security and cut the cost of living are simply too big to ignore. It continues, Mr. Speaker, with our energy security, where I say once again, oil and gas will be part of our energy mix for decades to come. But, Mr. Speaker, we do not set the global price for oil and gas. And households across the country are fed up with international events beyond their control, pushing up their energy bills. And I stand with them on that. So we will go further and faster on our mission to make Britain energy independent, because that is the only way we get off the fossil fuel roller coaster and take control of our energy bills. Finally, Mr. Speaker, we must strengthen our defence security. That means boosting our armed forces as we have, with the biggest sustained investment since the Cold War. It means doubling down on the most successful military alliance the world has ever seen, the NATO alliance, of which this party in government was a founding member. But it also means strengthening the European element of that alliance, taking control of our continent's defence more robustly, deepening our partnerships, have we done with our deals to build Norwegian frigates on the Clyde, Turkish Typhoons in Lancashire, not only, Mr Speaker, creating thousands of secure jobs and opportunities for our defence industry right across the country, but also enhancing the way our armed forces can collaborate with our allies. Because, Mr Speaker, as the Middle East conflict shows once more, the world in which we live has utterly changed. It is more volatile and insecure than at any period in my lifetime. And we must rise to meet it, calmly but with strength. That is exactly what we're doing at home and abroad. We are strengthening our security, taking control of our future, and building a Britain that is fair for all. And I commend the statement to the House.
Kevin Bailey, not Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. And can I thank the Prime Minister for advance sight of his statement? I would also like to pay tribute to our brave servicemen and women serving in the Middle East right now. Mr Speaker, the Prime Minister is right that Britain did not start this war, but whether we like it or not, we are impacted by it, and this is likely to get worse. The cost of borrowing has jumped, petrol prices are climbing, inflation is rising and living standards falling. It is time to take decisive action in our national interest. Britain must focus on what is in our power to protect British citizens today. First, we must rapidly solve the energy crisis this war has caused in our country. And second, we must make sure that Britain is ready to defend herself in this new age. A nuclear-armed Iran is an existential threat to the UK. We should be in no doubt whose side we're on in this war, our allies in the Middle East and the United States. So I welcome the Prime Minister meeting some of those allies, and I also welcome his support for diplomatic efforts and military planning to restore freedom of navigation in the region. But we will need to go further than just talking. He says Britain stands ready to play our part. We can all see that we were not ready for this situation. Here's what we need to do now. First, we must take rapid action to increase our energy security and keep bills down, not just until July, but longer than that, permanently. Britain is particularly vulnerable to energy price shocks because we are killing domestic oil and gas production in the North Sea. Labour's policy of more expensive energy and deindustrialisation at this time of crisis is dangerous and irresponsible. It is also harming the defence industry. We must start drilling our own.
Well, that's Kemi Badenoch on her feet in the House of Commons. We will carry on listening across that for you. I have to say that very few of you are impressed with what the Prime Minister had to say before her. Mark says he talks a lot but does absolutely nothing. Matthew says another summit, just words, no money for defence. And Amanda says, so a party political broadcast for the Labour Party. What's he going to do about it? More in John Pienaar's programme. He takes over from us at 4 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee, 6 minutes to the hour now.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep. Where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters. On your doorstep. based on 2025 Amazon packaging data across the UK and EU.
You've saved carefully for your future, your plans, your peace of mind. Now there's good news. FSCS protection for your savings and current accounts has risen to £120,000 per eligible person at UK authorised banks, building societies and credit unions. From the very first pound right up to £120,000, it's all protected, so you can focus on what matters with confidence. See what it means for you at fscs.org.uk. Your savings, FSCS protected.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
We're going to squeeze in Adam Shaw, our personal finance man, in the last couple of minutes of the show. Now, the new Employment Rights Bill promises to make work fairer and more secure. Business journalist Adam is with us now. So tell us, what will it mean for workers, first of all?
Well, there's a lot of new protection coming in with this new Employment Rights Bill, which comes into force now, but the various elements get dribbled in. It's a sort of combination. I don't know if the right word is a mélange. Is that the right collective noun for a group of disparate laws? But a mélange of employment rights. In particular, for instance, statutory sick pay, known as SSP, that's one of the big changes. I was really surprised. It's only been around since 1983. So before 1983, there was no statutory sick pay. I'm not sure what would happen if you were too ill to go to work. But up until now, you had to wait for 3 days before you got it. And the lower earners, surprisingly, were excluded. So very low earning people who you might think would be most in need of this support were actually excluded. The new law will mean that protection is brought in from day one. And a little over 1 million workers who weren't entitled to statutory sick pay because of a lower earnings limit. So if they earned below £125 a week, they will now become eligible. And this is particularly significant, I think, for a lot of women workers who are overrepresented in lower paid jobs and part-time work, as well as disabled employees and indeed younger and older workers. So there are a number of groups of people who I think will benefit in particular from this new law of statutory sick pay.
Okay, and the changes to 0 hours contracts, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a huge bone of contention for some years. The Employment Act is not going to ban them, but it introduces major reforms to tackle what the government has been calling exploitative practices. They're designed to give workers on 0 hours and low hours contracts more predictability and security. So you've got a right to a stable contract, a right to a contract that reflects the hours they regularly work, your right to notice for shifts. You'll be required to give workers reasonable notice of their shifts, compensation for cancelled shifts, and a right to be informed about those new rights. Because, of course, none of these rights are any good unless you know you can claim them. So no guarantee, no changes to the guaranteed hours, but a right to predictable hours.
Right. I wish we had more time, Adam, but people who don't like this believe that there's now too much power in the hands of the workforce and employers are going to be put through the mill a little bit.
Well, someone always has to pay this, although I should say that things like maternity pay, although it is paid for by the employer, they usually get that refunded through their tax. And I don't think this is such a huge problem for employers. I think the lower income guarantees have been more of an issue, especially in the hospitality trade. But these, I think, are generally thought to be a good thing.
Adam, we really appreciate your help this afternoon. So sorry you got so squeezed by geopolitical forces mightier than our own.
We did get a bit squishy, didn't we, in the last half an hour of the programme. You'll be able to spread out in the company of John Pienaar over the next 3 hours. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was and always is and hopefully always will be Ryan Boyden. Up next, it is John with Drive. Have a lovely evening when you get to it.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. A public inquiry has found that Axel Rudakabana wouldn't have carried out the Southport attack had his parents reported their son's erratic behaviour to the authorities. And Donald Trump has warned that Iranian attack ships will be eliminated if they approach a US naval blockade in the Strait of Hormuz. And coming up, Catherine Philp, the World Affairs Editor for The Times, is going to be joining me as the US blockade of the Iranian ports comes into effect. And Viktor Orban, 16-year-old rule of Hungary is over, and I'm going to be talking to Kira Rudik, the Ukrainian MP, who's also an opposition leader.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. A public inquiry's found Axel Rudakabana wouldn't have carried out the Southport attack had his parents reported their son's erratic behaviour to the authorities. Chairman Sir Adrian Fulford says the murders of three girls at a dance class in July 2024 could and should have been prevented. His reports highlighted systematic failures by a range of organisations. Solicitor Nicola Brooke represents three adult survivors.
We ask that he would go a step further and call those agencies to give evidence during phase two, so that they face the public scrutiny of what they've done to implement those recommendations. That's the only way we think we'll see real change.
Donald Trump has warned Iranian attack ships will be eliminated if they approach a US naval blockade in the Strait of Hormuz. Tehran says American restrictions on international waters amount to piracy, warning no port in the Persian Gulf or Gulf of Oman will be safe while Iran's are under threat. Sir Keir Starmer has announced he'll convene a summit of leaders this week to help ensure freedom of navigation. Speaking in the Commons, the Prime Minister also said the Israeli bombing of Lebanon was wrong and should stop now.
Whilst the ceasefire between the US, Israel and Iran is undeniably welcome, it is also highly fragile. The region remains on edge, and a lot of work is required to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, to de-escalate the situation, leading to a sustainable ceasefire. In pursuit of that goal, we call for Lebanon to be included urgently in the ceasefire.
Hungary's new prime minister insists his government will do everything to start a new era. Peter Magyar says he'll work every day and every hour of the day to improve the country's security and development. Gregory Roos is director of the Europe and Russia and Eurasia programmes at Chatham House.
What has really made him stand out is absolute rejection of corruption and also the criticism of the tightened grip of the government on the media and the judiciary, which had become too obvious to many voters at a time when inflation was on the rise, where commodity prices were on the rise, where energy prices were on the rise.
A US judge has dismissed Donald Trump's $10 billion defamation lawsuit against the Wall Street Journal. It's over an article claiming the president's name was in a 2003 birthday book given to Jeffrey Epstein. The president has a fortnight to decide whether to put forward an amended version. Ministers hope proposed changes to school lunches in England will tackle obesity and tooth decay. Sausage rolls and pizzas could be replaced by whole grain breads and pasta. Anna Taylor is executive director at the Food Foundation.
We really need to be using every possible route we can to make sure that children's diets are packed full of nutrition. And of course, schools provide a really major opportunity to do that because they're feeding children 190 days of the year.
For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello and welcome to Drive on Times Radio with me, John Pienaar. It's good to have your company. To the surprise of absolutely no one, there is no deal in the Iran war and none in sight after that weekend peace talk in Pakistan. So now what? When prices are rising, fuel prices rising faster since Iran blocked the vital sea route for oil and commodities, the Strait of Hormuz. And 2 hours ago, the United States Navy imposed its own naval blockade on Iranian ships too. Or at least that is President Trump's declared plan. The idea, it is to, well, President Trump has a clear plan at all. It's to hurt Iran the way Iran is hurting the world economy. But would it work? Can it work? Who will blink first? I'll get the latest in this standoff from our World Affairs editor at The Times, Catherine Philp, and be talking live to military and strategic experts. And meanwhile, Keir Starmer in the Commons says he'll have nothing to do with the escalatory US blockade. So what will he do to ease the pressure on British consumers? What can he do? He's now addressing the House of Commons as I speak. We'll have the news of that in just a short while. When he says Britain will play a leading role in opening Hormuz Strait, well, when the hostilities end, that is, what does that mean? Anyone think they know? Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio. And a little later, Viktor Orban has been thrown out of office in the Hungary election, to the dismay of his chief cheerleaders Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Now, how is it possible to describe the leaders of Russia and America being joined in a common cause? Well, it's very easy, actually. Just ask Ukraine fighting Russia and suddenly now more frank in accusing President Trump of siding with the Kremlin. I'll get the latest on this Hungarian election. I will be here getting reaction to what is a hugely significant result from Kyiv and from Brussels, which has been locked in battle with Orban's pro-Putin, so-called illiberal democracy for years. Stay with us. First, though, US naval forces have moved in the last couple of hours under orders to enforce a blockade in the Gulf of Oman and the Arabian Sea, east of the Strait of Hormuz. It is after peace talks between Iran and the US failed to make any progress at the weekend. Keir Starmer, meanwhile, has been giving a statement on the Middle East in the Commons.
Whilst the ceasefire between the US, Israel and Iran is undeniably welcome, it is also highly fragile. The region remains on edge, and a lot of work is required to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, to de-escalate the situation, leading to a sustainable ceasefire. In pursuit of that goal, we call for Lebanon to be included urgently in the ceasefire. Diplomacy is the right path, and I welcome the talks taking place this week. Hezbollah must disarm, but I'm equally clear Israel's strikes are wrong. They are having devastating humanitarian consequences and pushing Lebanon into a crisis. The bombing should stop now.
So that's Keir Starmer, who's speaking as I speak in the House of Commons. We'll have more on that statement and the reaction of Westminster a little later in the programme. Now, then, let's welcome to the programme Catherine Philp, the World Affairs Editor at The Times. Hi to you, Catherine.
Hi, John.
Hi. At this early stage, since the scheduled imposition of the American blockade, is there any indication of what is happening in the Strait? Iran is still in control, of course, and the US Navy, well, they're starting to do what they are being ordered to do, one assumes. But has anything changed or is anything happening?
I think all we know so far is that the price of oil has gone up rather predictably in anticipation of this happening. It is now in force. We're getting some conflicting messages about exactly what it means in terms of US military action. So on Saturday, two American warships did actually pass through the Strait of Hormuz. That was the first time they had done so since the conflict began. But they left the same day, and essentially they were just there to, I suppose, as a confidence building measure to kind of demonstrate to people that you could get through that way and not go around the Iranian corridor that they've put in place. But they are now east of the Strait.